This is episode 310 of That Shakespeare Life. That Shakespeare Life is supported in part by listeners just like you who join our listener community on Patreon. You can join us as a patron right now at patreon.com/thatshakespearelife. And stay tuned after the episode for even more details.
Hello, I'm Dr. Ian Mortimer, the author of The Time Traveler's Guide to Elizabethan in England. Another great method for studying the life of William Shakespeare includes listening to this. It's That Shakespeare Life with my friend, Cassidy Cash.
So the Geneva Bible and its various editions was the most popular English Bible during Shakespeare's time, and he clearly had a copy that he read at home.
Welcome to That Shakespeare Life with Cassidy Cash. Cassidy believes that if you desire to successfully learn or perform Shakespeare's plays, then understanding the real life and history of William Shakespeare himself is a must. That Shakespeare Life is the podcast that helps you go beyond the curtain of some of Shakespeare's most iconic works and explore the world of early modern England as Shakespeare would have lived it, learning from the writers, historians, and performers who know it best. And now, here's Cassidy.
One of the most significant influences on Shakespeare's work is the Holy Bible. There are references to biblical characters and even specific Bible verses found throughout Shakespeare's works. Of course, the original Bible was not written in English, but famous translators of the Bible, including John Wycliffe, who created the first modern English translation of the Bible produced from the original biblical languages, did exist during Shakespeare's lifetime. During Shakespeare's lifetime, the Protestant Reformation fueled more Bible translations to be created, including Erasmus's version, who wrote a New Testament in 1519, which was the source book for Protestant reformist Martin Luther when he translated the text into German in the mid-16th century. Subsequent editions of Erasmus's text also provided source material for William Tyndale, whose English translation of the Bible has been called the most influential single translation of the Bible ever made into English, an opinion backed up by the fact that King James's version of the Bible, published in 1611, is over 90% copied straight from the Tyndale Bible. Altogether, there were at least 9 English Bible translations completed in the early modern period, and of those, 3 were published during Shakespeare's lifetime. Here today to take us back to the 16th century and explore the history of the Bibles being translated and their significance are experts in history of Bible translations, Jacobus and Cynthia Nodia. Jacobus Nodia and Cynthia Miller Nodia are both senior professors in Hebrew at the University of the Free State in South Africa. Their areas of expertise include biblical Hebrew, that is the Hebrew of the Old Testament and the Hebrew Bible, as well as translation studies in general and biblical translation in particular. They served as translation consultants in South Sudan, which will be published in 2024. Jacobus was a member of the editorial committee of the 2020 Afrikaans Bible Translation Project for the Bible Society of South Africa. They have published widely on the history of English Bible translation, ideology and theology in biblical translation, semiotics, and the cultural dimensions of Bible translations, and the metatext or paratexts in the Bible translation. You can find out more about Jacobus and Cynthia in the show notes for today's episode, along with a list of their work that inspired today's episode. Hello, Jacobus and Cynthia. Welcome to That Shakespeare Life. When I was researching the Bible translations, I was able to find at least 9 translations of the Bible produced between 1500 and 1800, and it seems to have been dangerous work to produce these translations. William Tyndale, for example, was executed while translating his version of the Bible, with English versions of the Bible already existing before Tyndale took on his project. Wycliffe's Bible was completed in the 14th century. Why was it so important to people like Tyndale to go to these great lengths to see the project completed? And why were so many people after him willing to continue this work? I mean, on a practical level, looking at this, wasn't one English translation sufficient? Why wasn't everyone just reading Wycliffe's work and calling it a day?
Thank you very much for this very interesting question. To fulfill its purpose, a Bible translation must be intelligible, meaningful, and relevant for its users. So the ordinary layperson's even the boy at the plow, so to speak. So Bible translators need to try to satisfy these needs of their clients, the Bible users, during the specific time of their translating. But in life, there are at least 3 things that cannot be avoided: death, taxes, and change. And change causes a Bible translation to become unintelligible, meaningless and irrelevant for its users. So change is the impetus for new Bible translations.
The first and biggest change during the past 1,000 years in the West, if you look into the Life Millennium by Life Books, was a move from handwritten to printed Bibles by the publishing, or the first printed Bible in 1455, the Gutenberg Bible in Latin. The so-called Wycliffe Bible translation in English, about 1580 to 1588, were handwritten and hand-copied, which restricted the distribution of the translation. The English Bible translation associated with William Tyndale since 1526 was printed. Printing enhances the publishing. It is far quicker than copying by hand, and the distribution to more users of a next Bible translation. The invention of printing opened a completely new chapter of Bible translation history.
A second kind of change that's an impetus for the next Bible translation is language change. Over time, all languages change all the time. Old English changed into Middle English during the 14th century. That was the language of the Wycliffe Bible translators. And then into Modern English during the 16th century, the language of Bible translation since William Tyndale. Sentences that are intelligible, meaningful, and relevant for one generation become suddenly unintelligible, meaningless, and irrelevant in a next generation. So if we look at a contemporary example of how quickly language can change, we can look at a verse from the Bible translation called The Message, which was published in 2002, 21 years ago. Using contemporary colloquial expressions at that time, it translated 1 Corinthians 10, 23-24 as follows. Looking at it in one way, you could say anything goes because of God's immense generosity and grace. We don't have to dissect and scrutinize every action to see if it will pass muster. The language used in this 2002 translation is the same language that readers at that time used in their jobs and in conversations with friends. But now the expression to pass muster is outdated, and the translation of the verse has become unintelligible, meaningless, and irrelevant for its users. The Wycliffe Bible translation in Middle English in 1380 to 1388 became unintelligible in the time of William Tyndale at the beginning of the 16th century, and could only be understood by comparing it to the Latin text, which made the English translations of William Tyndale since 1625 a necessity.
A third kind of change as an impetus for a next Bible translation is ideological change. That is change in the sociocultural contexts. An example is a Protestant Reformation propagating the view that all people are directly responsible to God, that the Bible must be obeyed and not canon law, and that the Bible must be available in the vernacular for laypersons to read. The Protestant Reformation produced an astonishing wave of Bible translation that swept across Reformation Europe. In 16th century England, the various Roman Catholic, Anglican, and Puritan viewpoints influenced the emergence or the merit of Bible translation during this century. Though forbidden by the Roman Catholic Church to translate the Bible into English, William Tyndale produced in Europe an English New Translation, New Testament by 1525 with the assistance of colleagues that was smuggled into England and Scotland, where it was very popular. And in February 1531, the Reformation Parliament acknowledged Henry VIII as supreme head to the Church of England and the Christ, and another translation had been made by Moss Coverdale to fulfill this needs of this church. It was published in London in 1535 as a Coverdale Bible, the first complete Bible in English. When Tyndale was arrested, John Rogers took Tyndale's translation. Remember, Tyndale's translation was not finished, and he finished that translation as the so-called Matthew's Bible, which was published in 1537, and King Henry VIII licensed 1,500 copies of it a year after the execution of Tyndale. Therefore, the Matthew Bible is the first Bible legally sold in England. And by the end of 1537, the cover Bible and the licensed Bible were now licensed, and that caused a battle over an official standard Bible. So to solve this, a new translation was needed, and Henry ordered to translate the Great Bible, and that was the Bible which was published in 1539 as a Great Bible, and that was a Bible which was put in the church. Queen Mary then ascended the throne in 1553. She forbid any private reading and possession of the Bible. So there was a migration of Protestants from England to Geneva, and they were engaged in a translation, a new translation of the Bible, the Geneva New Testament of 1557 and the complete Bible of 1560 with many theological and exegetical notes. And then in 1558, Elizabeth I ascended the throne after the death of her half-sister Mary. She declared the Church of England again triumphant and supported the public reading of the Bible. And despite the popularity of this Geneva Bible, church leaders of the Church of England considered the Calvinistic notes offensive, and so they suggested to undertake another official Bible translation, and that became the Bishop's Bible. And with the ascension of King James in 1603, the revision of the English Bible would fascinate the world for centuries was conceptualized the King James Version. To meet the Protestant challenge and to prevent Catholics from reading heretical Protestant translations, the English Catholics abroad in Reims produced their own translation of the New Testament in 1582 and the full Bible in 1609 to 1610. It contains doctrinal marginal notes and annotations on the sacrifice of the mass priesthood, the primacy of Peter, penance, counsels, and precepts, etc.
Okay, so a fourth impetus for change for a new Bible translation is when there is new knowledge of new texts, so rediscovery of Hebrew and Greek text to be reflected in the translation. So, for example, Erasmus's Greek New Testament, published in 1516, was very important for new Bible translations. William Tyndale used Luther's translation of the New Testament, Erasmus's Greek New Testament with its parallel Latin version, and the Vulgate as his source texts. And Miles Coverdale didn't know Hebrew or Greek, so he consulted the Latin, various English and German Swiss translations to guide him. So the Geneva Bible then used the Greek New Testament of Stephanus in 1550 and Beza's Latin translation in 1556.
A fifth impetus of change for a new Bible translation is a meaning-making knowledge of the incipient languages. So suitable terms needs to be found to fit meaning and ideology and in an emerging English Bible language. And this search explains a 20% difference between the Tyndale and the King James versions. In the Tyndale translation, a simple style and words were rendered in a Protestant way. For example, repent, do not penance, congregation instead of church, elder instead of priest. Coverdale, he coined the word loving kindness. In the Taverner's Bible, the first time the word parable was used. In the Geneva Bible was for the first time all Old Testament portions, which were left untranslated by Tyndale, were then translated from the Hebrew. So to conclude, therefore, to keep the Bible alive, it needs to be retranslated, revised, and edited regularly. Otherwise, the Bible will die. Bible translations emerge to reach a subsequently higher state over time and follow a particular trajectory, for example, the Tyndale King James Version tradition, influenced by factors such as language change and ideology.
So which of these Bible translations are actually considered early modern Bibles, and how many were printed for the first time during Shakespeare's lifetime?
So according to this Stratford-on-Avon Church record, Shakespeare was baptized on 26 April 1564 and he died 23rd April 1616. Other more than 352 editions of the English Bible, which were printed from 1525 until Shakespeare's death, about 164 editions of the Bible were published during Shakespeare's lifetime. During Shakespeare's lifetime, the following complete Bible translations were published: the Bishop's Bible in 1568 and again in 1572 as a second folio edition with corrections, and 19 editions later on until 1617. The Douay Rheims version, the New Testament, was published in 1582, reprinted in 1600, and then the full Bible in 1609 to 1610. And then the King James version in 1611.
But there were these previous editions that were really quite relevant for Shakespeare's lifetime. So the Tyndale translation had 41 editions between 1525 and 1566. There were 7 editions of the Coverdale Bible until 1553, and 21 editions of the Great Bible until 1569. Until its ban in 1644, 140 editions of the Geneva Bible were translated. There were also smaller editions that are not much mentioned. So there was Lawrence Tomlin's New Testament in 1576, which was revision of the New Testament of the Geneva Bible. Then in the Geneva Bible itself, there was a very interesting new translation of the Book of Revelation in 1599, which replaced the original version of the translation of Revelation and added very anti-Catholic notes as well to that translation. And then another important one was the Sternhold and Hopkins, the Psalms of David in English meter. So these were the Psalms translated as English poetry with English meter, and those were often included in the Book of Common Prayer as well. So there was a wide variety of translations, really an explosion of translations that were available in Shakespeare's time.
So which of these versions of the Bible would have been most accessible to someone like Shakespeare? Can we know which Bible Shakespeare was most likely using for his source material when we see references to the Bible in his plays?
Let us first indicate which versions Shakespeare did not use. It seems that he did not have access to or use a Wycliffe Bible translation, and he did not use a Douay Rheims Bible. It seems that the publication of the King James Version was too late to have any influence on his writing work, since he wrote his last play in 1613. There are more than 1,400 biblical references listed by Nasheb Shabin in his massive work on the Bible in Shakespeare. The vast majority of Shakespeare's biblical references cannot be traced to any one version, since the translations within the Tyndale King James Version tradition are often too similar to be differentiated, 80% similar, and they are adapted when borrowed. Let us look at a few examples.
Okay, so the first example we're going to look at relates to the account in the New Testament, the accounts in the New Testament of Jesus' crucifixion, where it's said that he is translated on Golgotha. Then the meaning of Golgotha is explained by the New Testament writer. In the tragedy of King Richard II, Act 4, Scene 1, Golgotha is described as follows. Shall this land be called the field of Golgotha and dead men's skulls? Now, the particular phrase, dead men's skulls, is distinctive. That's the, in other words, the translation of the word Golgotha that's used in Shakespeare. Now, this translation is found in the Book of Common Prayer, 1559, in the Tyndale Bible, in Matthew's Bible, the Geneva Bible, and the Bishop's Bible. So just to take one example, the Bishop's Bible says of Jesus, and they brought him to a place named Golgotha, which is by interpretation the place of dead men's skulls. By contrast, the King James Version and the Douay-Rheims use other expressions. The King James Version says, and they bring him unto the place Golgotha, which is being interpreted the place of a skull. The Douay-Rheims is quite interpretive here. They say, and they bring him into the place called Golgotha, which is being interpreted the place of Calvary. So it's quite clear that this particular phrase, the place of dead men's skulls, is found in certain of the Bible translations and not in others. And Shakespeare is drawing upon particular biblical translations for his expression in the play.
There are about 120 references to the Psalms in Shakespeare's plays. A translation of the Psalms by Mills Coverdale was considered the best, and as said, this translation of the Psalms found their way in the Great Bible, some editions of the Bishop's Bible and Anglican prayer book, the Psalter of the Church of England, which was said or sung daily during morning and evening prayer and learned at school by heart. The Psalter was frequently bound with copies of the popular Geneva Bible in addition to the Geneva Psalms. Whenever this references verbally resemble a particular version of the Psalms, it is almost always a Psalter rather than the Geneva Psalms.
So our example for this is the word span or handbreadth. So in the famous history of the life of King Henry VIII, Act 1, Scene 1, it said, my life is spanned already. I'm the shadow of poor Buckingham. Now, Shakespeare's drawing from Psalm 39, verse 6. In Coverdale, Matthew's Bible, the Great Bible, the Prayer Book, the Psalm says, behold, thou hast made my days as it were a span long, for man walketh in a vain shadow. By contrast, the Geneva Bible, Bishop's Bible, the King James Version use the expression a handbreadth. So, for example, the Geneva Bible says, behold, thou hast made my days as an handbreadth. Surely every man in his best state is altogether vanity. The Douay-Rheims, again, is completely different. Behold, thou hast made my days measurable. So they leave out the metaphor of the breadth, the handbreadth, or the span.
Outside the Psalms, there are about 80 instances in which Shakespeare is closer to several related versions.
Okay, so a good example is the word cherub or cherubim. This is a winged angelic being that's described in biblical tradition as serving God. It's a loan word from the Hebrew keruv into English. Because it's a loan word, the word appears in various forms, both in Shakespeare's plays and in the translations of the Bible. So in the famous history of the life of King Henry VIII, Act 1, Scene 1, he uses the term cherubines with an N, not an M, cherubines, making it plural, cherubines. Their dwarfish pages were as cherubines, all gilt, the madams too. So here he's talking about the carved statues of cherubim in the church that were often gilted or covered in gold. In the tragedy of Hamlet, the Prince of Denmark, Act 4, Scene 3, he uses the term, however, cherub. I see a cherub that sees them, he says. In the tragedy of Macbeth, Act 1, Scene 7, he uses the term cherubim, or heaven's cherubim, horsed upon the sightless couriers of the air. So in general, as Shakespeare uses cherubim for the singular and cherubines for the plural, except for the passage in Hamlet, where he uses cherub for the singular, and Macbeth, where he uses cherubim for the plural. In the Book of Common Prayer, 1559, in the morning prayer to Deum Laudamus, it says, to thee, cherubim and seraphim, continually do cry, holy, 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 Lord God of Sabaoth. So the word is cherubim with an N. The Latin and Greek form was adopted into Old English as a singular, and the plural then became cherubines. Thus, cherubine and cherubims were the Old English singular and plural forms. In the 16th century, acquaintance with Biblical Hebrew, which has keruv in the singular and keruvim with an M in the plural, led Bible translations to substitute cherub as the singular and cherubims as the plural. However, there's still considerable variation among the English translations. So, for example, Tyndale will have cherubims, the Matthew's Bible has cherub and cherubims, etc. There's a lot of variation that goes in those. Finally, in the Geneva, the Douay Rheims, and the King James Version use cherub and cherubims, so it becomes a bit more standardized as they go along. Shakespeare's usage seems to be influenced by the Te Deum in the morning prayer, which he heard. This is the popular older version, rather than of any particular biblical translation. And it seems that then the shift in the 16th century Bible translations does not influence his usage.
Outside the Psalms, where it is possible to differentiate, Shakespeare references are often closer to the Geneva Bible than to any other specific version. There are about 50 references in his plays in which Shakespeare clearly refers to the Geneva Bible. One example is...
So in Twelfth Night, Act 2, Scene 5, it said, "Wilt thou set thy foot on my neck?" The phrase "set thy foot on my neck" relates to Joshua 10:24. In the Geneva Bible, it says, "Set your feet on the necks of these kings." And they came near and set their feet upon their necks. The Matthew's Bible, the Taverner's Bible, the Great Bible, the Bishop's Bible all say, "Put your feet." And the Coverdale Bible says, "Tread." Another example is in As You Like It with the word husks, where in Act 1, Scene 1, it says, "Shall I keep your hogs and eat husks with them?" Shakespeare here is alluding to the parable of the prodigal son in Luke 15:16. And he's clearly using the Geneva Bible, which says that the prodigal son, he would fain have filled his belly with the husks that the swine ate. The word husks was used in the Geneva Bible for the first time. The other versions all use the word cods. So it's clear that Shakespeare is quoting here the Geneva Bible.
In about 7 instances, Shakespeare references are closer to the Bishop's Bible.
So one example is in Love's Labour Lost, Act 4, Scene 3, where it says, "For charity itself fulfills the law, and who can sever love from charity?" Shakespeare here seems to be referring to Romans 13:10, where the Bishop's Bible says, "Charity worketh no ill to his neighbor. Therefore, the fulfilling of the law is charity." All other versions have love instead of charity. In one passage, however, Shakespeare refers to both the Bishop's Bible and the Geneva Bible. So in A Winter's Tale, The Winter's Tale, Act 4, Scene 4, it says, "We are but plain fellows, sir. A lie, you are rough and hairy." And here Shakespeare's drawing from Genesis 25, verses 25 to 27, the birth of Jacob and Esau. "So he that came out first was red, and he was all over as a rough garment." Bishop's Bible says, "a hairy garment." "And they called his name Esau. But Jacob was a plain man." The Bishop's Bible says, "a perfect man, and dwelt in tents." So Shakespeare here is combining both the word hairy and the word rough in his translation. So he's combining both of them.
It is quite possible that the King James Version is inspired by Shakespeare's usage. Alternatively, Shakespeare and the translators follow the same strategy to combine the most poetic phrases of the Bishop's Bible and the Geneva Bible in this instance to achieve a purpose. And the KJV reading and the first time out read, "All over light and hairy garment, and they called his name Esau, and Jacob was a plain man dwelling in tents." So how he adapted the text which he borrowed, Shakespeare appropriated the piety that marked the morality plays he saw in his youth and adapted them. The morality plays, which have a religious underlying structure, climaxed in a moment of vision that signaled the protagonist's redemption, a vision that pointed beyond the everyday and was familiar to a truth that exceeded moral understanding. Yes, Shakespeare turned the sacred into popular entertainment. At times, he greatly intensified the fear, and at other times, he greatly intensified the laughter, as in A Midsummer's Night Dream.
So in Act 4, Scene 1, he says, "The eye of man hath not heard, the ear of man hath not seen. Man's hand is not able to taste, his tongue to conceive, nor his heart to report what my dream was." Shakespeare here is drawing upon 1 Corinthians 2:9. So the Geneva Bible, "The things which eye hath not seen, neither ear hath heard, neither came into man's heart, are which God hath prepared for them that love him." So Shakespeare has taken the New Testament and has now applied it to his dream.
No one version can be called Shakespeare's Bible. Although he knew the popular Geneva Bible and the later Bishop's Bible, the influence of other versions are clear in Shakespeare's plays. There are many passages throughout Shakespeare's plays in which Shakespeare is closer to these other versions where they differ from the Geneva Bible. One must keep in mind that during the 16th century, the mode of communication was still hearing dominant and not really text dominant, although Bibles were printed. The church was a site of Shakespeare's early learning. The age of 5 or 6, he would have been expected to attend the sermons and the reading of the prayers of the common prayer book and the homilies about which he might be questioned by his teachers. And text became impressed on his mind, not only from hearing, but also from reading the Bible and from everyday conversation in a religious Bible reading age. And the homilies reflected the doctrines of the church and state as approved by the Queen. In other words, good English citizenship he heard from the homilies. Shakespeare came to know the Bible very well, and it is one of his most significant sources. Phrases and images returned to him when he needed them, so that the Bible became for him an echo chamber of the imagination. The Bible was translated into English at the insistence of religious reformers. Utilizing their translation, Shakespeare returned with his own plangent and resourceful language. He characteristically took materials that had already been in circulation and infused them with his supreme creative energies.
We know that the King James Version was published in 1611, but it's, as you've mentioned, almost a complete copy. I think you said 80% copied of the Tyndale Bible. Why did James go to the trouble of producing this new version if he was just going to reproduce Tyndale? And what are the major differences between these two versions that made the King James Version necessary?
In 1603, when King James VI of Scotland became King James I of England, the variety of English translations was a source of division among religious groups in England. And to reconcile these differences, the king called for a conference to be held in 1604 in Hampton Court. Both Anglican bishops and Puritan clergy were invited to consult together about religious tolerance. After much debate about the imperfections of the current English Bibles, it was proposed that a new translation, or at least a revised translation, be made. King James, who had a personal interest in Bible study and translation, endorsed the idea. A list of procedures and rules was compiled. One of the rules specified that the bishop's Bible was to be followed, but that certain other translations should be used where they agreed better with the Hebrew or Greek, namely Tyndale, Coverdale, Matthew's Great Bible, and Geneva. Some of the wording of the Douay-Rheims translation was accepted into the King James Version, including ecclesiastical terms from Latin origin like penance, chalice, altar, host. Another rule stated that marginal notes should not be used except for explanations of Hebrew or Greek words. 9,000 such marginal notes were eventually included. The King James Version was a subsequent revision in the process of emergence of English Bible translation. The idiom and vocabulary can be described to the Tyndale translation, the melody and harmony to Coverdale, and the scholarship and accuracy to the Geneva Bible. One must acknowledge that the final product was certainly the best English Bible that had been produced up to that time. And with the publication in 1611 of the King James Version, the controversy over English Bible translations ended. Initial dissatisfaction gave way to increased approval so that eventually it superseded its predecessors and rivals.
So to answer your question more precisely, why was the King James Version necessary? I can give a few examples. There was new knowledge of the meaning of, for example, of Greek terms that were used. So in Luke 6:23, the King James Version says, "Rejoice ye in that day and leap for joy, for behold, your reward is great." Tyndale had had "Rejoice ye then and be glad." King James said, "Leap for joy." And the King James Version translation, it has been retained in many translations since then. So the New Revised Standard updated edition 2022 again says, "Leap for joy." It's the best translation of the Greek. Sometimes there was an English term that was emerging and that the King James used. So, for example, in Romans 15:1, the King James says, "We then that are strong ought to bear the infirmities of the weak." Tyndale had said we ought to bear the frailness of them which are weak. And so the word infirmities was a new word that's now been changed in more recent ones, but that was an emerging word at that time. And then there's a question of the emergence of a theological concept. So in Ephesians 4:27, the King James Version says, "Neither give place to the devil," or the Tyndale, however, says, "Give no place unto the backbiter." So the New Revised Standard Version, updated version 2002, also says, "Do not make room for the devil." So the King James was modifying various things that were different from the Tyndale in order to make a better and more meaningful translation.
So we've talked about several versions of the Bible, including the Tyndale Bible, Matthew's Bible, and Coverdale Bible, all of which bear the name of their translator. Why does the King James Bible not refer to a particular translator?
None of the Bibles within the Tyndale King James Version tradition actually bears the name of a translator or official on its title page, other than that it is the Holy Bible containing the Old and New Testament. Note that a Bible translation is usually done by a team and not a single translator. It is a task that is too enormous for an individual. The popular names used to refer to these translations are for convenience sake. Concerning the Wycliffe Bible, although his translation is attributed to John Wycliffe, there is no convincing evidence that any translation was done by Wycliffe himself. At least the names of two associates are known, namely John Purvey and Nicholas of Hereford. Although William Tyndale did the translation task of his Bible translation, he had assistants who assisted him in the work and whom he consulted, for example, Miles Coverdale and John Rogers. They completed their task after his death as a so-called Coverdale Bible and Matthew Bible. On the title page of the Matthew Bible, it is attributed to Thomas Matthew, an invented neutral name, perhaps inspired by two of his disciples in the New Testament.
So the Great Bible was called the Great Bible because of its size. So that's how it got its name. The Geneva Bible also had a large number of translators, including the theologians William Whittingham, the brother-in-law of John Calvin, and the primary translator Miles Coverdale. The linguists and scholars Anthony Gilby and Thomas Sampson were also engaged in the translation of the Geneva Bible, so it was a team effort. The King James Bible does contain a two-page dedication to the king, but it wasn't translated personally by him. So the committee that he said that he put together in 1604 was 50 scholars, consisting of 6 panels, 3 for the Old Testament, 2 for the New Testament, 1 for the Deuterocanonical books. 2 of the panels met at Oxford, 2 at Cambridge, and 2 at Westminster. King James undeniably ordered the selection of the translators. He authorized the process by which the work was carried out, and he kept a distant eye on the committee of his scholars, but he actually had nothing at all to do with the translation work.
The Douay-Rheims Bible and the Bishop's Bible were available in Shakespeare's lifetime, with the Douay-Rheims New Testament being printed in 1582 and the Bishop's Bible was issued in 1568. Were either of these Bibles considered official copies that were used by the Church of England? And did the average person have, I know you mentioned Elizabeth I said it was okay for there to be public readings of the Bible, but would an individual like Shakespeare have had a Bible in their home? And if so, which of these versions would have been most common for that purpose?
During the reign of Elizabeth I, the decree that a folio Bible in English should be in every parish was reaffirmed. And during the 1560s, this folio remained the Great Bible of 1539, which had been authorized by Henry VIII to be read in parish churches to fill the needs of the Elizabethan church. The Great Bible was printed in 1561, 1562, and 1566. The Geneva Bible cast light on problems with the Great Bible. As a result, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Matthew Parker, and his team revised the Great Bible to be published in 1568 as a Bishop's Bible. The Bishop's Bible was then the official Bible of the Church of England during Shakespeare's lifetime. It was licensed by Queen Elizabeth I as the only one to be read in churches in order to draw to one uniformity. The provinces of Canterbury in 1571 laid down that every archbishop and bishop was to have a book in his own house, and deans were to see that it was bought and placed in their cathedrals in order that vicars, minor canons, the servants of the church, strangers and wayfarers might read and hear it, and were also to buy it for their own households. The Bishop's Bible was a pulpit Bible authorized for public reading in churches and therefore did not have the controversial Calvinistic notes that distinguished the Geneva Bible, because it was not really intended for private reading.
The English Catholic scholars in exile under Elizabeth in Reims in France produced their own alternative translation of the New Testament, as you said, in 1582. In 1609 to 1610, having moved to Douay, they produced the translation of the Old Testament to form the Douay-Rheims version. This translation was a scholarly and polemical version. It was not an official version in England or for the Church of England. And scholars in England were very quick to reply to this new version. The Protestant scholar William Fulk in 1583 published a volume refuting the Rheims New Testament and defending the Bishop's Bible. He then collated and annotated the Rheims New Testament in parallel columns alongside the 1572 edition of the Bishop's Bible to prove that the Rheims New Testament was inferior to the Bishop's Bible. Fulk's parallel edition was first published in 1589, and as a result, this Catholic version, the Rheims text and its notes, became easily available in England, which is quite surprising. Without Fulk's parallel edition, the Rheims version would probably have been largely ignored. So during Elizabeth's reign, there was one Bible for the church, the Bishop's Bible, and one Bible for the people, the Geneva Bible.
If the people have your question to, if average people have a Bible in their home, which version? This is a period of the domestication of the Bible in Europe. And before this age, the handwritten or manuscript Bibles had belonged mainly to churches, religious institutions, and the great houses of wealthy people, because Bibles had been expensive and remote. The encounter with the Bible was mainly via oral communication. As a result of the invention of movable type, there is a move from oral communication to print communication. Especially between 1520 and 1550, printed Bibles entered the households of men and women at all levels of society in the everyday language of the time. By 1534, it is calculated that over 30,000 copies of the Tyndale translation were circulating in England. In 1825, the Bodleian Library received a collection of 21 English Bibles and New Testaments, which were privately owned from the estate of Miss Lisa Dennis Diner, all represent editions published in England before 1580.
So when Elizabeth made Matthew Parker the Archbishop of Canterbury in December of 1559, he approved of the Geneva Bible, particularly for reading at home, and he allowed it to be printed in England for 7 years. After that, no more Geneva Bibles were printed until Parker's death in 1575. He allowed only a monopoly for the printing of the Bishop's Bible. It seems certain that the Archbishop cared little for providing Bibles for private reading. He met the needs of suitable editions for the service of the church, but he did not trust the people with cheap editions of the Bible, and his lack of confidence in the end sealed the fate of the bishop's Bible. After 1575, Geneva Bibles were produced in huge quantities in every format in England. Between 1576 and 1611, there were 15 editions of the Geneva Bibles or New Testaments. So the Geneva Bible and its various editions was the most popular English Bible during Shakespeare's time, and he clearly had a copy that he read at home, possibly a medium-sized quarto or else a more inexpensive octavo version.
Concerning the cost of a Bible, the King James Version was published in 1611 and originally sold for £4. That is about $1,600 in 1998, while the first folio of all Shakespeare's plays published in 1623 sold for £1, about $400 in 1998. Despite printing, Bibles were still limited and expensive until the creation of the British and Foreign Bible Society in 1804, with the aim to produce affordable Bibles. Literacy was still low. There is evidence that Shakespeare's father and mother were probably illiterate. In Horton and the Edge alone, it was recorded in 1551 that 9 clerkey did not know how many commandments there were. 33 did not know where they appeared in the Bible. 168 could not repeat them. 10 could not remember the creed. 39 did not know where the Lord's Prayer appeared in the Bible, 34 did not know its author, and 10 were unable to recite it. Assuming that an average person could afford an octavo-sized Bible and was literate, there would have been a popular Geneva Bible at home.
With all of these Bibles floating around in Shakespeare's lifetime, as well as all the political and religious tensions surrounding which ones were too Calvinist and which ones were too Catholic and whether or not to have notes and all of these questions, I wonder if there was any specific version of the Bible in English that was considered illegal for Shakespeare's lifetime. Were there any that you would have gotten in trouble for reading or paying attention to?
This is very interesting, yes. But a complicated question since... There was licensing in terms of printed works and printers and censorship was prevalent.
So when Elizabeth became Queen of England, she confirmed in 1558 a charter that her predecessor, Queen Mary, had made for the Company of Stationers in London. And they were then licensed to produce and print books. So what they wanted to do was to produce texts that were to prevent the publication of texts that violated the laws of the land. They wanted to make sure that they protected the monarch from treason. They wanted to make sure that the church settlement did not have opposition. Elizabeth ended up issuing 11 proclamations, and although they did not impose regulations on printing generally, they imposed censorship on particular texts. 6 addressed Catholic texts that issued from continental presses, 1 a principally political work, and 4 radical Protestant, what she considered radical Protestant texts. The first proclamation, which was entered in 1569, described the books by continental Catholics.
So King James once censured in December 1604 the play, The tragedy of Gowrie after it was performed twice before large crowds by the King's Men of Shakespeare, because I was violating the English Elizabeth taboo on representing living magnets and contemporary, near contemporary events, since someone would have to play the part of King James. In terms of Protestant Bibles in the Elizabeth era, the Great Bible and the Bishop's Bible, as well as the Geneva Bible, in terms of their printing licenses, were legal. They differed with respect to their status as officially used in the Church of England, as indicated previously.
The question of the Catholic translation of the Bible that we've already mentioned is much more interesting. The production of an English translation of the Bible by Catholics was relatively late in comparison with the other English translations. It was clearly seen as necessary to counteract the influence of Protestant English translations. The Douay-Rheims New Testament, published in 1582, was during a time when Catholics in England were under increased pressure and persecution, both for religious and political reasons, which were often intertwined. So Catholics were under pressure to conform to the sacramental practice of the Church of England. Catholics were often seen as potentially treasonous with their loyalty to the Pope rather than the crown. Both the translation and the publication, however, of this Bible took place outside of England. The publication, as we've said, provoked a fierce response from Protestant scholars in England, especially since it was produced using the Latin Vulgate as a source text rather than the Hebrew Old Testament and the Greek New Testament. The Catholic Bible also had extensive footnotes promoting Catholic interpretation and devotion. And this, it was similar to the Geneva Bible, which had extensive footnotes promoting a Calvinistic interpretation of the Bible. So we've already mentioned that Fuchs' work in publishing this Douay-Rheims Bible side by side with the Bishop's Bible, and it was licensed to be published in England. Therefore, one would think that the Douay-Rheims Bible would not be positively looked at, and in general it was not, but it was in fact published in England alongside the Bishop's Bible, for the purpose of saying that it is not an acceptable translation of the Bible.
So the Geneva Bible, the problem was that it was not so much a wording of the Bible, or the Geneva Bible. The main problem with the Geneva Bible was his extensive marginal notes.
And these notes were an original feature of the Bible. So the title page of the Geneva Bible mentions these notes and talks about how they are annotations upon all the hard places, things that are difficult to understand. The problem with the Geneva Bible was many of the notes were fine. In fact, many of them were incorporated into the later King James Version. But what was not fine were notes that related to the monarchy, that were critical of the king, that were critical of church polity, and then that had a particularly Calvinistic interpretation. And that was the issue that the Church of England often found very uncomfortable. We mentioned earlier the Book of Revelation, which the later Geneva Bible had very harsh anti-Catholic and also very strident, we could say, notes in the Book of Revelation.
Obviously, there is a massive amount of history to explore and unpack when it comes to biblical translations from Shakespeare's lifetime. For someone that is new to this history of Bible translations and the politics and religion of this time period, the internet or even a library can be a daunting place to know where you're supposed to start when wanting to learn further. So we like to ask you, as experts in this topic, what are some of your recommendations for where we should begin when we want to explore this history further?
Well, you're correct that there are a huge number of publications on the early English Bible translations, and we've listed some of these on your website for listeners. But what we think is actually most interesting and illuminating is actually to read these early Bible translations firsthand through facsimile editions. So they're now facsimile editions, replicas of the early translations of Tyndale, Coverdale, the Geneva Bible, and the King James Bible. Many of them are published by Hendrickson Publishers. They're high-quality editions. They contain very helpful introductory essays on the specific translation. And by seeing them and reading them on the page, you get a very nice feel for the translation itself.
Now, we ask everyone this next question here at That Shakespeare Life, and that's, what's the one book you would take with you on a deserted island? My friends in England tell me I'm supposed to allow you the complete works of Shakespeare and a copy of the Bible, so your choice would be in addition to those.
This sounds like punishment.
It's supposed
we
to be rest.
We have struggled with this question because we are lovers of books, and our house and offices are full of books. We finally decided that we would request that our copy of the Bible be both the Hebrew Old Testament and the Greek New Testament rather than an English or Afrikaans Bible translation. Since we are a couple, we hope we can each take two books.
Of course, I think that's fine.
One book, two books, one each. Since we love history and art, Jacobus would like to take Arnold Tonby's A History of History, A Study of History, and Cynthia would like to take Janssen's History of Art. Between Shakespeare, the Bible, history, and art, we could read happily for quite some time, hopefully until we would be rescued from the desert island.
I think that is an excellent selection. And yes, you would have the full scope covered there and be quite well set up on your deserted island. So what's next for you? What are you working on now that you're excited about?
So concerning our project on the history of the Bible and religious translation, we're interested in how translation, and especially Bible and religious translation, shapes culture, as well as how language shapes Bible translation. So to achieve this, we study the history of other translation traditions besides the history of English Bible translation. So one such translation is that of the Afrikaans Bible translation. The first complete Bible in Afrikaans was published only 90 years ago in 1933. We've just discovered an early proof draft of three biblical books, the Gospel of John and the books of Hosea and Jonah, produced 13 years earlier in 1920. So we're going to look at the variety of Afrikaans that was used. Now, this document was considered lost, but we discovered it in a storage book of unidentified documents in an archive. So we're looking at the language that was used and looking at the decisions and the strategies of the translators as reflected in that draft and how they influenced the version that was finally published in 1933. What's interesting is that although it's nearly 400 years later than Shakespeare, the language situation of Afrikaans is similar to that of English at that time. When Shakespeare was born in 1564, English itself was only just settling into its current form. No dictionary had yet been written. Although Shakespeare coined hundreds of English words himself, he would not be able to produce world-class literature and enrich English culture if there were no 16th century Bible translations and the translations of Greek and Latin literature available to him.
This is exciting stuff, and I'm just thrilled to have taken this look into this history. We will have links to Jacobus and Cynthia's work in the show notes for today, of course, so that you can follow all of these exciting things that are coming from their work. And I just want to thank you so much, Jacobus and Cynthia, for being here today and helping us take this look at the Bible and its translations as it was happening for Shakespeare's lifetime and the influence this event had on his works. This was a really great conversation, and I appreciate you being here to share it with us.
Thank you very much.
The show notes for our episode today includes more information on Jacobus and Cynthia Nodia, along with direct links to their work. On the show notes page, you will find their complete list of recommended resources, and you can find exactly where you want to go because we'll put the direct links right there. Find this whole list and this information at CassidyCash.com/episode310. That's CassidyCash.com/EP310. If you love our show and you like learning about Shakespeare's history here with us each week, then consider joining our listener community on Patreon. You can support the show and access bonus content, including video versions of the podcast, animated versions of Shakespeare's plays, exclusive documentary films, and more. Plus, there's special membership options like digital downloads and a monthly Shakespeare book club available at the higher patron tiers. Explore all the benefits of being a patron here at That Shakespeare Life and sign up today at patreon.com/thatshakespearelife. That's patreon.com/thatshakespearelife. As they mentioned, Jacobus and Cynthia have provided an excellent list of research material. They've sent that to me over email, and I will put this entire list, including their publications that inspired today's episode, all in the show notes for today. You can find all of these recommendations on our website at castycash.com, and they're available completely free with the audio today, so stay tuned for the URL for where to find those extras. That Shakespeare Life is researched and produced by me, Cassidy Cash. Our audio engineer is Gary Mayholm. That's it for this week. Thank you for listening. I'm Cassidy Cash, and I hope you learn something new about the Bard. I'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to That Shakespeare Life. As always, the best conversations happen after the episode over at CassidyCash.com. Become a part of a vibrant Shakespeare conversation by adding your voice over at the website. Until next time, remember, when you want to know William Shakespeare, you have to go behind the curtain and into That Shakespeare Life.